Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. It's like coffee with an analyst, or it could be whiskey with an analyst reading a spreadsheet, linking crime events, identifying a series, and getting the latest scoop on association news and training. So please don't beat that analyst and join us as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 6 years of law enforcement analysis experience. She spent time with the Chicago Crime Commission, Murfreesboro Police Department, Naperville PD in Illinois, and is just about to take a gig with the Ohio Narcotics Intelligence Center in Ohio. She holds a master's in criminal justice from Loyola University in Chicago. She's here to talk about, among other things, call data record analysis software. Please welcome Elizabeth Bukola. Elizabeth, how are we doing?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me, Jason.
And how is Ohio today?
Surprisingly really nice. Like, it should get up into the high 60s today. We've had some pretty good weather these last couple of days. I shouldn't say that too early because it did snow on Sunday and we might have some more coming.
Oh, man, that crazy March weather. And I just got done interviewing Cindy Peterman, who I think you're about to go do some work for.
Yes.
All right. So, yeah, I don't mean to get too much Ohio in these days, but it just happened that I got two people in fairly short order from Ohio. So I'm looking forward to getting your perspective as you're just about to get in to ONIC. Certainly talked to Cindy in great detail about ONIC, and now I'm looking to get your perspective in terms of you're just about to get on board with that center. So let's start from the beginning, though. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
So I discovered it actually when I was a child. My mom, is really into true crime. She was constantly like getting books in the library, reading different books and watching different specials on TV. So it started to pique my interest when I was in high school. She started to let me read some of the books she had or watch some of the TV specials. And so I always knew that I was going to go into law enforcement. I just didn't know in what capacity yet. I was like, I want to solve crime. So I was like, I'll be a detective. But then I realized you have to be a police officer to be a detective. And I didn't know if I wanted to be a police officer. So it actually wasn't until I was in grad school that I really kind of found the profession of crime analysis. So let me backtrack a little bit. I received my bachelor's at Tiffin University here in Ohio in forensic psychology. So this major actually blended the two professions into one. So it looked at criminal justice and psychology. So this allowed me to kind of pursue two different avenues if law enforcement wasn't 100% on board with that. So I was able to kind of double dip into those. And then for grad school, I studied at Loyola University in Chicago, and I received my degree in criminal justice and criminology. So this is when I kind of saw more of the different principles of law enforcement. Like, there is so much different avenues you can go into in this profession beyond just being a police officer. And so there, I took a statistics class with Dr. David Olson, and he brought in a criminal intelligence analyst from the Chicago Police Department. So she mainly worked with CPD's data, but she discussed like what her job was and what some of her partners did. And I was like, I want to do that. So that's kind of how this all got started. And at the time, I was volunteering with the Chicago Crime Commission. So during my undergraduate studies, I started there as an intern to fulfill that requirement. And I stayed on because I really liked it and kind of did. I needed to have something to do outside of grad school. So I wasn't just like studying all the time. So I volunteered with them and they eventually hired me on as a research analyst. And at the Chicago Crime Commission, my like primary responsibility was working with their current research analyst on their new edition of the gang book. So when I was an intern, they started working on this, and this gang book is pretty much a dictionary and a who's who guide to Chicago's street gangs. And it was a law enforcement resource as well as a resource for schools, hospitals, businesses, just to say like, hey, this is what the current makeup of Chicago gangs is. And this is a good resource for you to like protect yourself, identify these if you think somebody may be in a gang, etc. So while I was in grad school, the research analyst left. He went on to pursue a new job. So since I was kind of already there, I just kind of fulfilled that position and helped the team finish that book. So that was published shortly before I actually went to Murfreesboro. You can get it on Amazon if anybody's interested. It is a little outdated because it's 2018, but it's still a really good resource.
Regarding that, are the gangs want to be known? Or was it difficult to gather this information and get all the particulars about the gangs in Chicago?
Yeah, so in the book, so like it starts off as, so like the whole first chapter is naming the, I guess, the key players of each gang. Mm-hmm. And these individuals were very well known to every law enforcement. And I can't remember the legal documentation, but in order to be named a gang member, they have to fit a certain number of criteria. So we made sure we followed all of that. So like some of them would be self-identified or arrest history of like gang activity, felonies, or just like known to be in those areas. But everybody in that book is self-identified, very proud that they are a top member. And in fact, we had, after that book was published, Chicago police officers and detectives like told us that when they went and conducted search warrants on some of these houses, they found that gang book at their house. So like they were also using it. So like most of it was self-identified. We worked with the Cook County Sheriff's Office to get most of that information. They had an investigator there who was just Chicago gangs 101, everybody, and he knew everything. So he had files upon files of documentation on all of these individuals.
I think in general, you have your gangs, you might have graffiti or signs or colors that they wear. Was there maybe some gang trends that aren't typical that maybe you just see in there in Chicago, or something that surprised the group as they were doing this project?
Yeah, so like I think the biggest one was the traditional hierarchy of a street gang definitely shifted in the early like 2000s to late 2000s, after the feds and local law enforcement really came down on leaders. Once a lot of these leaders were getting arrested and prosecuted, you kind of cut the head off the snake and they didn't know what to do. So a lot of these bigger gangs factioned off into even smaller gangs. So there's a lot of almost like inter-gang conflicts. So now, instead of having these main traditional hierarchies of gangs, it's broken down into factions almost block by block. Like you could have gangs under the umbrella of the Gangster Disciples, but they're still going to fight with each other because you'll have somebody who like 61st and 55th, like their gang, but they could fight with the next gang over at the block. So there was a lot of that was a shock to us, as well as working with the law enforcement partners to do this project, is like, okay, we don't have these traditional gang boundaries anymore. How do we convey that to the public? So that was the big thing, is like all of the factions, like, and the faction names change very quickly. It could be like if a prominent member in that faction was shot and they want to honor that person, they're going to change their name to honor that person. And a big thing that we saw was the emergence of drill rap. So a very popular artist that came out of Chicago was Chief Keef. And basically they rap about what they're doing in their gang. So it was a lot of like diss tracks or like threats were made using music. And that was another thing that, like, talking to Chicago police detectives and police officers was like, we listen to this because we know, like, okay, retaliation is going to come from like this song and like threats on social media. So that was like really fascinating to me, was to see all that. And that was definitely something that was unheard of to more of like the old school traditional street gangs, because a lot of those threats, like you said, would be graffiti and signs. That stuff happened on the street, but then it transitioned to stuff more on the web with rap videos and social media.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey in terms of gangs over the last 20 years, getting into obviously what you mentioned with social media and YouTube and other video services, where you could just post a music video on your own. Whereas 30 plus years ago, that those types of avenue just weren't available. So it has been an interesting journey of just different avenues of communication, just like I guess all of us in society, but certainly gangs aren't exempt from that type of communication.
No, they're not. So yeah, that was like the biggest kind of like trend that we picked up on and wanted to focus on, since it was such an emergence at the time. And now like things have changed so much that we'll have to do another book.
Yeah. Well, I would think that it would get outdated pretty quickly, right? If you had a leader, and you have several leaders now, as you mentioned, the hierarchy is flattened, that you're going to have different leaders and you might have boundaries changing. And so there's probably, it is going to get stale pretty quickly, but it seems to me that they were, I just imagine that somebody's really angry that maybe either you got their name misspelled or you got a fact wrong in the book. And they're like, and they're upset because, hey, like, that's not right. It should be this. It would be funny if they called you up and say, hey, you got this wrong.
Now, that would actually be really funny. Like, especially because we would include their alias name as well. So if they're like, oh, that's actually not my alias.
I didn't look it up, and I should have, but I mean, with the gangs moving from more of a hierarchy model to a flattened model, and you said that there's different factions more infighting in there, I would imagine then that the violence would also be more. Before, you had a couple of gangs, and they're going to try to keep the peace. If they're in certain ways, it's probably easier to keep the peace, less violence, if you just have a few big gangs in Chicago. Whereas if you have all these different factions, it's flatter now. It's probably harder to keep the peace. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I definitely think so. Like So when we were working on this, like 2017, 2018, we definitely saw some of that. And like even looking at like who's committing the violence, it was much more juvenile on juvenile crime. And we theorized that with the lack of a leader in these gangs, juveniles were kind of just doing their own thing. And because traditionally leaders kept the underlings like in check, like they're like, okay, you can't do this, you can't do that, and they would be like reprimanded for breaking the rules within their gang. Well, I think that just kind of went out the window with the lack of the leadership. So it became more like juvenile on juvenile. And I really haven't been, since I've moved out of Chicago and Illinois, haven't been keeping track on what's going on now. But I think with like COVID, the rise of juvenile crime and violent offenses like really kicked off. Like they had issues with like the Kia Boy problem was big, just a lot of carjackings and robberies being committed by juveniles. So I think they saw a spike in that, but I can't say for sure.
Okay, so let's get you moving on to Murfreesboro. Said, what went into that decision going from Chicago to a smaller town outside of Nashville, Tennessee?
Yeah, so as we're kind of wrapping up this book, I knew what I wanted to do. So I started to research the profession more and started looking for jobs. So it's very difficult to find a job as a crime analyst fresh out of school. I maybe applied to upwards of like 100 agencies at this time, just trying to get my foot in the door. And I, at the time, like I was young, I just graduated with my master's, I was single. Like, I'm going to go wherever this job takes me. And so at the time, I actually had two job offers, one from Austin, Texas Police Department, and one from Murfreesboro, Tennessee Police Department. And so I sat down with like my friends and my family. I was like, okay, what do I do? I was like, Austin's kind of big and Murfreesboro is the complete opposite. It's very tiny. So ultimately decided to go to Murfreesboro, and it was because Murfreesboro was closer to home. So if I wanted to, I could just like drive back. So I wasn't ready to make the like cross country move. So yeah, so that's what that came down to it. And then I was kind of bummed because like right after I moved to Murfreesboro, Austin had their male the bombings, like they're receiving packages with bombs in them. And I was like, dang, I could have been while they were doing that. Like that would have been like my first week on the job. So I was like, oh, that's a little bumming. But I still got to see some cool stuff in Murfreesboro with like our nexus to Nashville. So it worked out. But yeah, so like I moved down to Murfreesboro with no knowledge of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And so leading up to it, I studied everything I could on just like Murfreesboro in general. Like I looked at demographics of the city surrounding it, because I was from Chicago and I grew up in a suburb of Chicago, very, very dense population wise. So going to Murfreesboro, I was like, wow, I am in the country. And it was quite the shock. But with Murfreesboro, it became, because Nashville at the time was receiving an influx of people. A lot of 20 to 25 year olds were moving to Nashville. And so Murfreesboro was kind of seeing that spillover. And the population grew faster than the infrastructure. And while I was there, which is like fascinating to see, but also there's just traffic all the time because they have one main road. But working down there, it was really nice because it showed me like, okay, here's how this police department operates compared to what I'm used to up north. And at the time when they hired me, they had an analyst already there. And he was the second analyst I hired. They had a girl before him for a few years. And she was very data stats driven. And so is my partner. And I did data and stats to the level that I needed to perform the job. It was not like my favorite, but I did it. So I really liked more of the case support investigative side of this profession. And so we kind of provided a really good yin yang. But going in, I didn't know what Murfreesboro needed. And we were both kind of hired under the guise like having a crime analyst looks really good on paper for our police department. Let's do it. And we kind of had to figure out as we went, like, okay, what do they need? And it was really difficult at first because we were both from up north. So coming in as these two foreigners to tell officers who had been patrolling the same area longer than I've been alive, and I'm trying to tell them to stop doing that and you should start focusing on this other area, was a little difficult because they would just look at me like, why should I listen to you? So we had a lot of like proving our worth to them. It was a lot of trial and error. Like once you found one, it kind of snowballed after that. So like I assisted detectives on identifying a juvenile robbery crew. And once that happened, I was like, hey, this is your guy that you need. And it was like mind blowing to him. He's like, how did you figure that out? And I explained to him like, oh, I did this. Like he was involved in another armed robbery, like over here. And like, so he then went to everybody else. I'm like, look what she just did for me. Like she could do this for you too. So it kind of snowballed after that, which is like really nice because that's kind of what you need because they'll listen to each other. So then like requests started pouring in and it kind of gave us like, I don't know, made me and my partner feel good. Like, okay, what we're doing is working and we're not just like turning our wheels in here, just trying to figure out like what we need to do for them. So that was like, that probably took us like 6 months after I started to finally get like a groove.
Yeah. And I think all analysts go through that. I mean, even
yes.
You mentioned that this was fairly new, the department was fairly new to analysis, but mm-hmm. I do feel that every analyst goes through that of proving themselves and seeing what value that they have. So I don't think you're necessarily alone in that. It is daunting though to yeah. come in. And we talked about this a little bit in a prep call yesterday. I feel that some people are really good at, you give them a blank slate and tell them to go, they'll build you a house or build you whatever you want and they're fine with it. I was mm-hmm. always of more comfortable with, I'm like, okay, you're going to have to box me in a little bit because I need to know that I'm hitting the mark with what you're actually looking for. I'm not as good at starting with a blank slate. If you give me a couple of the things that you're after, then I can do my thing and come in and build you what you want. So it's not for everybody, right? And it does take right. a little bit of, and it's certainly daunting being a civilian, coming into a sworn environment and dealing with folks, as you mentioned, that have been doing the job longer than you've been alive. So it is a lot. And that's a story that I hear over and over and over again.
Yeah. So it was definitely challenging and sometimes a little like disheartening when we'd be sitting in a room and you're very proud of a product you just did. And then they're like, this means nothing to me. Like I already know all of this. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, sure. And then you're like tail between your legs, walk back to your office and try to perfect your product. So it meets what they're looking for. I think so, like Murfreesboro though, so like my partner and I had both moved on, went back up north. They have now, so like the analysts they hired after us, very talented people. I still like have talked to a couple of detectives there and they've said like, okay, they leadership understood what they needed and then they got it right. So like the team they have now, I hear is really good. They're doing a great job. I think they're up to maybe 4 analysts. And I think there's talks of having like a real-time crime center there. So I think it just like takes a little bit because like we were the first ones and like we were new and fresh to the profession too. And it's like, okay, we don't know what they don't know, but they also don't know what they need to know. And so just like working with that communication, it's like, okay, what can we do to help you? And at the time I didn't know how to do that because like this is the first time I was working in a police department setting. And but like, fortunately there are resources out there like the IACA that both my partner and I use to like, okay, like here's like stuff for tactical crime analysis. Let's just start churning stuff to see what sticks with them. And so that kind of worked and talking with the heads of like different like specialized units and asking them like, okay, what is your threat? Like what would make your job easier that I could do? And so that kind of helped too, is just like trying to understand the problems that they are facing was easier for us than just sitting in our office, like trying to guess.
Yeah. No, you definitely need more. That's where you need more feedback sooner. You need little bits of feedback prior to going into this big reveal at the end. And that was one of the things that when I was at Cincinnati Police Department, I didn't do a good job of. Right. I really wish in some of the projects that I did that I would have had a small steering committee of sworn officers and other analysts to come in and consume my product before I went for the big reveal. And I think that I would have been able to iron out some of these issues that weren't apparent to me until I went for the big reveal. So it's definitely something that it is disheartening when you put the time and effort into something and then it doesn't take. That's a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah, it was, especially being so young and fresh in the profession. It's just like, oh no. But I progressed. So after Murfreesboro, I ended up moving back home to Chicagoland and landed in Naperville, Illinois. So Naperville is about 25-ish miles southwest of Chicago. And it is a pretty, like, very, I wouldn't say it's one of the largest suburbs, but it's definitely in the top 5 for suburbs and cities of Illinois. Similarly, so I was hired as just one analyst. And the biggest difference between Murfreesboro and Naperville is that they had had crime analysts for about a decade prior to me starting. So they saw the value and they understood the profession. So it was easier to kind of integrate myself into the department because I didn't have to like reinvent the wheel. I just had to modernize it. And so the analysts they had before, they had one who was mostly, I would say, tactical, administrative. And then the other analyst they had, she was housed with the special operations group and she was more intel investigations. So it's nice that they got to see all aspects of the job already before I started. So it was a little easier to kind of get the ball rolling, but I was all on my own. So that was a little intimidating. They had also had my desk right outside the chief's office. And that is a big no-no. And I had gone to my boss. He's the deputy director of administrative services. So he is a civilian supervisor who oversaw all civilian aspects, like at the deputy chief level. So like he had our PSAP, our dispatchers, the records unit, IT, and then myself. And he was a crime analyst himself. So his name is Russ Manson. He is a crime analyst for Elgin, Illinois Police Department for many, many years. So that is why they had him be my supervisor. And I learned a lot under him because he understood the job. So when I came with like frustrations or stuff like challenges I saw with like our data or anything, I'm like, how do I get this to work? He knew it. Like he spoke the lingo. So it's really easy to, So that was especially being like I had at the time just under 2 years of experience with the police department. He really kind of helped me kind of like get my foot in the door with like pushing stuff. And because of his proximity to the other deputy chiefs and the chief, it was a lot easier to kind of get that trickle down of my stuff. But
you said PSAP before?
Yeah, so that is, I don't know what the acronym spells out, but that was the dispatch. That was the dispatcher. So it's like public. I don't know. And I apologize. I probably should have looked that up before I said it. But yeah, so that's what we refer to our dispatchers at Naperville. Mm-hmm. So, and he also knew that I needed to get off the third floor. And that was the only way for me to like really work closer with like detectives and officers because nobody wanted to go to the third floor. And so the deputy chief of investigations was finalizing a list of people within the department to attend a called data records analysis training for the software ZX, or well, it's called Trax now, formerly known as ZX. And he had one spot left and he picked me. He was like, we're going to send the analyst. And so I owe him a lot because by him sending me to this training really opened that door for working with the detectives and the officers. So like the group that was invited was mostly detectives and then one of our, so like Naperville has a designated digital forensics unit. They're also detectives. So they, anytime there's like a computer, a cell phone, and electronics, they will do all the forensics on that and assist detectives with those final reports. But so like there, I got to know them better, like outside of the office. And then I became kind of like the guru of call data records. After that, like I pretty much received every request for every like call data records after. And because of that, they finally put me downstairs. So
you found your niche.
Yeah. So at this time, this was the same time when COVID picked up because we were not deemed essential being like civilian support staff. We were sent home and we had laptops and it was very difficult. Like, as you can imagine, being on the third floor was already difficult to work with detectives. Imagine being at home. And so we did everything we could and like crime kind of took a nosedive there. Anyway, so there was a lot of downtime. So I used all that time to like do free trainings through various platforms like NW3C, social network analysis. I read up on call data records, what the different carriers will provide you. I tried to like really understand what the data they were given to us so I could use that data better. When we returned back to the office, we were downstairs embedded with the detectives. And so that's when it really took off from there because the way our office was set up was like good and bad. We were right next to the copy machine and the coffee maker. So we had a lot of foot traffic there.
Way more than the third floor, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it was nice that the detectives like saw us if they're on their way to the coffee maker, they're like, or the coffee maker and the copier, and they're like, hey, Liz, can you help me out with this? Like, I'm picking up the report from the copy machine right now. I'm like, absolutely. But sometimes when I was like really busy, I'd really have to put on my blinders, like, please do not talk to me. Like, I need to get this done. But so that was kind of nice. They eventually moved the coffee machine out of that area because it came a little bit too much foot traffic. But it all worked out because like we were right there. So it just gelled a lot better because we're fully embedded with investigations and we felt part of the team. Like, they're very welcoming. I never felt like an outsider or an outcast or anything. Like, so that was really nice. And like, they, since they already knew Crime Analysis, and so it was easier for them to be like, oh, I know exactly like what you can give me. And I could put, instead of like taking what they received from the previous analyst, I would put my own little twist on it. It's like, okay, well, I did it this way. And they're like, oh, wow, like, this is great. And so that was really nice. And eventually I was, well, both the, so then they hired another analyst right before COVID, and then we were moved to our special operations group. Like, we're still embedded with investigations, but we are also attached to our special operations group that was mostly doing like narcotics investigations, as well as the two sworn intelligence detectives. So we would work with them as well. And that's still how the current makeup of that unit is at Naperville, and it's going really well for them. So it took a lot, but what was nice is over the years, I think after returning from COVID, I earned the respect from people at all levels of Naperville to say like, hey, this isn't working out and I think we need to do this. And they were listening to it. And that was really nice, because that was not something I had experienced in Murfreesboro. And so having that like seat at the table at Naperville was just like, okay, this is great. Like, as an analyst, this isn't that common. So being able to voice like my opinion to like make things better was that was nice.
Yeah, there's certainly a level of comfort there. I
yeah,
can appreciate, and I think what you're saying about going to Naperville and then just them knowing analysis and speaking the language, and it's more of a group effort. And that's definitely something that I experienced is starting off my career, maybe one or two analysts assigned at a police department. And then once I went to that team concept, I was like, oh, I can go to you and just really get down in the weeds and talk shop. And we can work this thing out type of thing. And it was just a different environment once I went to a team concept where we were all the same. We were all, there wasn't that civilian versus swarm. And so there is a level of comfort there that I can see that you had. And I certainly went through something similar. And I also think that what a great opportunity, even though, I mean, it's COVID, and if we had the choice, we'd rather not have COVID go through. But I think in your situation, it was a really great opportunity that you took advantage of, because when you're in school or you get told about a software or maybe a technique, to learn it just for the sake of learning it doesn't necessarily go well sometimes. You just kind of like going through the X's and O's. I don't really know how I would ever apply this. But because you had been an analyst at Murfreesboro and you had spent some time in Naperville and you had some experience, now when you went to all this training with the COVID time, now you had a better idea of like, oh, I could apply this here, I could apply this there. And it was just an awesome opportunity to go in and learn as a professional as opposed to being a student.
Yes. Yeah. You're exactly right. Like, it was a huge turning point, like professionally for me. Cause like we were told like, okay, just like go home for 2 weeks, we'll give you a call back. And then that 2 weeks turned to like 7 months. And we ended up returning during the George Floyd protest. Naperville saw some of that as well. So like we were brought back into, we weren't back full time. We were on staggered shift. So I was like Monday, Wednesday, and my partner was like Tuesday, Thursday, and then we were both from home on Fridays. And it was like that for a good, I think, like couple of months. And then they're like, you're back full time, we will make this work. And but yeah, so that was huge because like we weren't getting that many requests because like detectives didn't have that many cases, and we were still churning out like our monthly product on Crime Stats, but there was a lot of downtime. So like I really was like, you know what? I like call data records analysis. I'm going to learn as much as I can during this time. And that that really helped me out in the long run. Because when I did return to the office, I was like, hey, I found out to do this and this and this. Or like, look what you can do now. And being able to use multiple platforms for the call data records was just like, I don't know. It's like mind blowing to detectives. But for me, it was like super cool. So it's like, look at all these cool tools I have. And I know how to use them now. And I didn't have like with I2, like we had I2 and I attended a self-paced training on it. So a lot of it was self-taught with like YouTube videos and reading documentation and just trial and error. So it's just like really satisfying to know like I taught myself this and I was able to figure this out using these like free resources I found online.
This is Amanda Wiggins, and my public service announcement for you, never underestimate the impact you're having on those around you and those that you never may even meet.
Hi, I'm Charlie Gioverti. One question that people ask me a lot is how to get respect and buy-in in an agency. And I always tell crime analysts, on day one, the most important thing to do is find the biggest police officer in the department and just knock his ass out in front of everybody. And that way, they'll all have more respect for you. What I mean by that is find the people who are your leaders, your informal leaders, your high IGEN value people, and win them over one at a time. Wow them, knock them out with what you can do and how you can make their life easier. And then they'll be the ones who go and get all of the buy-in before you.
Well, this is a good time to bring in your analyst badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is the career-defining case or project that an analyst works. And so we're at 2020, and let's get into how you applied your call data records analysis.
Yeah. So I received a request. So with the makeup of the Chicagoland area, there are a lot of task forces based on county because we had agencies that may not have had the same resources as other departments because they were smaller. So the task force reached out to me. They had a homicide in which the offender fled the scene and disposed of the gun prior to arriving at another location. And that was all the information I was told. All I want to know is where the crime happened and didn't want to know what the secondary location was because I found out with like call data records, it's better to go in a little blind when you're reviewing the data because you're not going to be pigeonholed into looking for what you want to look for. And so I received all of that data from the detective and processed it through our Track system. And those who are not familiar with Track Statistics, it's a online platform that allows you to input your call data and they will give you a KMZ file for mapping that you can bring into Google Earth Pro. And then they also have built-in features for looking at like link analysis so you can identify outliers in times of the calls, the type of calls, and who's making those calls. What I like to do with that is like, I would take my data, put it into Google Earth Pro, but I'd also take it and put it into ArcGIS. And so I'd use those tools like that you could find in their analyst tool set. So like I think they had like cell phone records, the feature class, the cell site, and then generate phone links. So what I did is first I started with Google Earth Pro. So I put in the KMZ. I organized my data within Google Earth Pro. I made sure my timeline bar was set correct. I also added in the date and the time and the address of the incident. So after that, I started looking at the offender's records in 15-minute increments. And so I was just trying to see like where he went. And I found that was like too large of a like a time frame. So I shrunk it down to 5-minute increments. And so I found out 30 minutes after the incident, he spends like 6 to 7 minutes right next to a river that's about a mile from where the homicide happened. And I was like, that's weird. So I wrote that down, highlighted it, took a screenshot, and I gave that to detectives like really fast. Like I messaged them and I with the screenshot and I was like, hey, he's like right here at this river for only like 5 or so minutes. And they're like, okay, thanks. And so about an hour later, she messaged me back saying they found the gun, he threw it in the river. So that was a huge, huge win for myself, because it was only like a 5 or so minutes. So like, if you're trying to look at these records big picture, that might be something overlooked. And so by having like broken it down like that, we were able to find that. So yeah, so that was like a really big one, specific case for me.
So was that river, was that out of the way for him in terms, you said 6 minutes, but at the same time, it, you're looking for like a pattern of behavior there that maybe mm-hmm. that was something where it was out of the way. It was something, there's something different about it in terms of why would he go there type thing.
So after he left the river, he goes to the casino mm-hmm. and it was not in the way. So like after I found out he went to the casino, I mapped out on Google the direction from the house where the homicide occurred to the, and this river was not the mm-hmm. quickest way to get there. Like it was almost a mile out. So we had that too, to show like, okay, this person went out of their way to get there. And that you like hit the nail on the head. So like with call data records, they always recommend like getting 90 days to establish that pattern of activity, to see like, okay, this person goes from A to B every day, but all of a sudden they're going to C when they should be going to B, like what's going on over there? And so that was always something that I looked for. And I would look at it more bigger picture, where like some of our detectives, when they would analyze their own records, they would shrink down their data set to like 12 hours before their crime and 12 hours after. And they're like, I got nothing. It's like, okay, well, you got to like widen your search and see more of what's going on with this individual and establishing that pattern of activity.
So, and then how big is this river? That's probably not as like a big detail, but I'm really impressed with, not only were you able to say, hey, this might be a possible spot for him to dump yeah. the gun, but then come around back to you like, oh yeah, we found it. So
I really think it was just like a little stream, like in between okay. houses.
Okay.
Like, because like the turnaround from when I said that to when I got the message, it was pretty fast. Because like I believe the situation was domestic in nature, so they mm-hmm. They got to him pretty mm-hmm. quickly. It was just a matter of like, okay, where's the firearm? Because they didn't find it on his person or in his vehicle, and I think they needed that to like really get like charges on him and stuff. And so I want to say it was a pretty small like stream between some houses, because it was in like Christmas. But yeah, I don't think it's like the Mississippi or anything like that, where they sent like a dive team. Like I think they literally walked to the area and could see it, because it was just like right there.
Oh man, like he had to yeah. be shocked. He had to be sure. absolutely shocked, because if you're thinking about it, just, you're driving, okay, I'm going to dump this gun. And you got to yeah. be thinking, like, even if they find the gun, like some randomly, maybe some kids find it or whatever it is, or the neighbors find it, they're not going to have mm-hmm. any idea to link it back to him. And so he had to be absolutely shocked that they figured out where it was in such a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. And wow. So, and that's a fantastic story, and just real time and real quick.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a few of those. Like we had another homicide. It happened over the weekend. So like Monday morning when I got into work, it was like, hey, we have all of the phones of everybody involved. Our digital forensics team is dumping the data, and they're sending you all of the like latitude, longitude, KMZ files. And I was like, okay, like, let's do it. So as the detectives were interviewing these individuals, I was typing up a timeline of their activity. So like for this one, because it was so fast paced in real time, I did only look at 12 hours before the crime happened and then 12 hours after, because I wanted to provide the detectives with accurate account of where these individuals are. So like if they're, when they're interviewing them, if they're like, wait a minute, like your cell phone says you're actually here, what's going on there? So that was kind of nice. Like it was very fast paced and I was like stressed out, but it was very like the adrenaline was going, and I was like typing stuff on my like Word document timeline and then like sliding it under the door for the interview. Like it was like stuff they make for the movies.
Yeah, no, but, especially passing handwritten notes. That is, that's going old school a little bit there.
Yeah, so like I would get like text messages from the secondary detective, like, hey, they said they went to a gas station before this. Can you identify where this gas station was? And I did. And then they're like, okay, they said they went to like an alias named house. Can you find the house and see who that person actually is? And I was like, on it. So like things like that, I was like trying to find in like real time. And it was really exciting. It was one of those days where like you forget to eat lunch and before it's 5 o'clock. And you don't want to go home because you want to like keep working. And I actually had to dip out early because my husband was actually at a training out of state and like we have a dog. So I had to get home to him. But I was like, can I just like run home, bring my dog back and like keep going? But that was an exciting one. It was, like I said, it was a rush. And it was nice, like, because in that moment, it's like, wow, I am so integral in this investigation that I'm playing like a role in assisting detectives with like identifying these homicide offenders.
Nice. Nice. Well done.
Yeah, it's very gratifying.
Yeah. All right. So what brings you to Ohio?
So what brought me to Ohio is actually my husband. So my husband is a DEA agent. And he was given his cities. We ultimately decided to go with the Cleveland division for him. And so it's kind of what landed me here. And it's actually like, it's very interesting because I went to undergrad in Ohio and my best friend actually grew up in the Cleveland area. So I was already kind of familiar with it and she still lives here. So this is the one city on his list where we knew people where we were going. And so that kind of all like worked out for us. And it's not that far from our home in Chicago. So if we wanted to go back, we could easily do that.
Yeah, I was thinking just the same thing when you mentioned wanting to be closer to home. So yeah, that's a good spot. Similar weather. So you're not getting really any much better weather though. But I mean, hey, I think what you can get.
Yeah. I know. Right. We turned up Miami, Florida for Cleveland, Ohio. And that's my husband. That was not the right
place. although, man, that's a big jump. Yes, you're getting out of the cold, but then you're dealing with like swamp ass in the summer, which is not.
And alligators and no, thank you. I'm okay.
Yeah, no, there's it's a different level of uncomfort there in Miami. So, exactly. All right, good. So then what are you going to be getting into with Onik? As I mentioned, I'm getting you at an interesting time where it's just before you're starting this new gig. And it's interesting from my point of view is that I like to get interview analysts at different points in their time. And so some people might say like, oh, why don't you interview me a couple months in? I was like, yeah. And I've interviewed analysts that start a new gig and a couple months later get their perspective. But here I think this is a good opportunity for us to talk about, hey, it's before you're starting. So what are your expectations? What are you looking to get into? And so it's another perspective and I'm interested to hear it.
Yeah. So I guess a little background with Onik is, so they are structured like a fusion center geared towards the drug narcotics markets and like disrupting that. So their main thing is they will do like digital forensic examination, intelligence analysis, and like case support for different law enforcement agencies in Ohio. And so Onik has offices in Columbus, Toledo, and Cleveland. So I'll be working in the Cleveland office. And what really attracted me to Onik is the whole like ongoing case support, intelligence, and like call data records and like digital forensics. So as I have talked on now for like 30 minutes about call data records analysis, I really enjoy doing that. And so I'm like really looking forward to being able to do that at Onik and just kind of hone in on that skill and see what kind of tools they have and how they married up with like some of the tools I'm already familiar with. Additionally, so like my husband works for the DEA. So like narcotics is kind of big in our family. So we can talk about that kind of stuff a lot. So I'm like really interested to see how our two professions might meet and see like what, like if there's things that will like overlap with that. So I'm like looking forward to that and kind of working together in a professional setting. So yeah, so like expectations, I've never worked for a fusion center before. So I've always worked for a police department. So I'm like really interested to see how they do stuff there with their shop and like what kind of tools they have. And like, it's going to be different because like my audience as an analyst was always like internal within my police department. And with ONIC, it might be like the Ohio Highway Patrol or a federal agency or a smaller police department like surrounding the Cleveland area. So I'm like really interested to see how all of that works. And but yeah, like I'm pretty excited about it. Like I think it's going to be challenging because it's different than what I'm used to, but I'm also like, I'm ready for it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's something that Cindy was talking about when I interviewed her is like, this is statewide. And yeah. I forget how many, I should know because she said it a couple of different times. I mean, there's hundreds of police department agencies in Ohio, and not all of them have the best resources, right?
Right.
And so you have, certainly the city will have more resources than the county, but the county has what you're talking about. They have these either domestic violence cases or they have homicides, they have violence, and everybody's using cell phones. And so they have these events happen where call detail records would be useful for the investigation. So I could see somebody like you helping out smaller jurisdictions in Ohio that don't normally have the resources to be able to do what you do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I agree. And like with some of these smaller departments, like they just might not have the time or the understanding of what they can even subpoena or get from the phone carriers. Like it might not be something they were in the know about. So I think we'll play a really good role in that. It's like, okay, hey, I have this case and what can I do next? Like, can I do a tower dump? Like I have a person of interest and here's why, like, here's my predicate for thinking this is my person and here's their phone number. Like what are the next steps? And I think we might be able to play a role in assisting them with that.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting. Cause I think one of the things I could imagine going from a smaller department to a fusion center, and especially a fusion center that's going to be a large jurisdiction like what you're going to see there in Ohio, is smaller department, once you're there a couple of years, you get to know the area, you get to know the players, you're going to be more familiar with that small data set that your study area, if you will. But getting into this fusion center, right? One week you might be dealing with something in Toledo. The next week you might be doing something in Ashtabula and who know, and everywhere in between, right? So I can imagine that's going to be hard to wrap your head around that aspect of it, of just really knowing these particular areas.
Oh, absolutely. Like in Murfreesboro, Naperville, I could just like tell my boss, like, hey, I'm going to go drive around to the different beats and just familiarize myself with some of these like major intersections or major areas. I'm not going to be able to do that. I can't just tell my boss, hey, I'm going to go drive around Summit County. I'll be right back.
Yeah. So no, it should be an exciting time. You will have the advantage of being in a fusion center, working with a team, working with like-minded individuals, like we talked about before. So as you get your cases, as you get your tasks, it's not like you're alone in the world.
Yes. Yeah. I'm like really looking forward to that. Like having a team of other analysts that come from different backgrounds. Hey, this is my experience at a police department. What can I bring to the table that is like different from them, and how we can all mesh together is something I am really looking forward to.
Let's get into some advice for our listeners then. And you were a mentor, and actually Charlie Gioberti was your mentor. And it was interesting, as I looked over our messages the other day, I realized that you were one of his analysts of tomorrow. When he was on the show, he declared who he thought were the analysts of tomorrow are. And I think I've you were the last on my list of people to interview on that list. So kudos to you that you made Charlie's list, but you obviously want to take this time to talk about mentorship.
Yeah, so I reached out to the IACA's mentorship program when I started at Naperville. I saw the value in it from like talking to some other analysts and was like, okay, this might help me get unstuck from my problems. And so they assigned me Charlie, and it was great. Like Charlie is very easy to work with. It didn't feel like he was an instructor. He felt more like a peer and was guiding me through different systems. And so one of the biggest problems I faced was understanding our data and how to extract our data into a product that was easy to understand by every level of law enforcement within my department. And he did a great job with helping me at that. And when I found out that he named me as an analyst of tomorrow in your podcast, I was actually like, I was very humbled and like, I wasn't expecting it at all. Cause like at the time I was maybe 3 years on the job at Naperville, and this is coming off of COVID, and I still felt like a new analyst. Like I still felt very beginner, like still trying to figure it out, like a little bit of imposter syndrome. Like, are you sure, Charlie? Me? So it was nice to see that that was like recognized. And I actually talked to him before I moved to Ohio and was like, I had a really good thing here in Naperville. Like, I don't know what to do. And he's like, you're a accounts analyst. What do you mean? And I'm like, am I? I don't know. And so like, I don't know. He's always been really supportive throughout my career, and I've got to see him at like different conferences. And so because of my experience with him, I've started to mentor new analysts any chance I get. So like I use like LinkedIn a lot. So like some analysts or kids in school will like reach out to me there if they're in the Chicagoland area, and I have a packet and I give them everything in that packet. And I was like, here's how you can get started. And IACA is always a huge resource for me, and I've always like given that to them, because I first joined IACA when I was still a grad student and trying to figure out like, okay, is this the job I want? And so I was like reading the different white papers they offered, and I was like, okay, yes, this is exactly what I want to do. So I always like first and foremost give them that information. It's like, okay, this is exactly what the job entails. Make sure this aligns with what you want to do professionally. And so that's probably like something I really enjoy about this job now, is just like helping newer analysts try to find that. Cause like when I was a newer analyst, I didn't have that in Tennessee. But then once I had it with Charlie, like it made all the difference for me professionally. So I want to like pass it on to somebody else.
Nice. And so actually, I just published a special podcast with Mike Jackson, who is the IACA mentor chair. So that's Analyst Mentoring Program, AMP. So he's always looking for mentors. If you're listening to this, you can help another analyst out. And maybe you're new to the profession. You certainly can be mentored as well. So I will leave a link to that podcast, and it has all the information to get you started, whether you're a analyst looking to be mentored or whether you're a couple years on the job and you can pay it back and be a mentor yourself. And I know Mike is also looking for a clever catchphrase for AMP, Analyst Mentor Program. So I'll reiterate that. If you have any suggestions there, email me at leapodcasts@gmail.com. All right. I'm sorry, Liz, I might have cut you off there. Did you have something you wanted to add?
Oh, no, like I was just going to say, like, even if you think you're a beginner analyst like I am, you're probably much more talented than you think. So encourage you to be a mentor, because you just never know that the thing that you might be really good at might be the one thing that somebody's like struggling with to accomplish in their role.
Excellent. Very well put. All right. So let's go on to communication then. And you've worked with several agencies, both big and small. And one of the things that law enforcement does struggle with from time to time is siloed data, right? Just being able to communicate back and forth. And that's why you'll hear so many analysts on this show talk about how important networking is. And being able to know another analyst from a different police department and being just that phone call away that I can call them up and say, hey, I need help with this. I can't, how do I get this data? How do I get this information? Help me out. And so, but wanted to get your perspective from your experience on siloed data.
Yeah. So first in Murfreesboro, when I started, they were still handwriting all of the reports. And as you can imagine, that presented many challenges for us. So as officers wrote the reports, they got approved by their supervisors. Those reports then went to records, and the records technicians had to enter all that information into an RMS system. So a lot of our stuff was delayed because it was just like at the hands of the human entering in that data. So that presented some challenges for us initially. And then they went to like a field-based reporting system shortly before I left, which was a lot easier. But that earlier system, we couldn't query the RMS for like narratives like at all. So like if we had a very unique MO and we wanted to just like maybe query the narrative for that MO, impossible. So the way that they had their reports. And so we found ways. So we started creating our own access database with our own like 1 to 2 sentence summary of the narrative ourselves. And we would use language in there that we could query. So like if it was like a dollar store break-in, the first words of that narrative would be like dollar store or stuff like that. So we could easily go back to it if we saw another one. And so, and then moving on to Naperville, they had multiple data sets feeding into different platforms. So like their CAD was separate from the RMS, the traffic data was in another system. And so when I started, I was just like, okay, I need to figure out where this data is coming from. How can I use this and like export it back in an easy way? And fortunately for Naperville, within their IT department, they still have a database administrator. And so this individual, he has a knowledge base of SQL, Python, Power BI, you name it. Like so he was able to assist me with that. I was like, I don't know what I'm looking at here when I'm trying to build out these tables, but he did. So we were able to work together to build out Power BI dashboards for our agency. And so what helped us, because like he didn't understand like the end product of what they wanted to see, but he understood the data going into it. So we were a really great team in that aspect. It was like, okay, I know what they want to see, but I don't know how to get it. So that really worked out for us with all that silo data. But I think the biggest thing for me is like overcoming that was I talked to everybody who had a role with the data. So like I met with the record supervisor weekly to discuss our neighbor's data and what she was giving the state to make sure those matched up with like some of the numbers that I was giving our chief for his presentation. Same thing with IT and traffic, which also kind of fed into records. But like I made sure to communicate with those people, like, okay, let's make sure we're all on the same page. And then if there are challenges in that data, we all knew how to kind of overcome those. So like if records is like, well, I need patrol to do X, Y, and Z, I was like, okay, like, let's schedule a meeting with patrol. So they're all in the room saying like, hey, there are all these moving parts and we're all trying to reach the same goal. How can we do that? And so that was like huge with us because that was something that I had learned with like communication. Record supervisor and like a traffic supervisor were never going to be in a room together. So we're trying to like bridge that gap with like, okay, we're all involved in this. Like, how can we make this work for all of us? And that was really huge with us for understanding our data.
Yeah, I think, I don't know what size the analyst unit would have to be, but I do think there must be a threshold there. And when do they get a dedicated IT professional for them?
Yeah.
So I think that was starting out with when I was at police departments. Some of the stuff is like, okay, I'm limited in terms of IT of what I need to do a better job. But at the same time, IT is, they're all busy. They all have maxed out assignments. They don't necessarily have the dedicated resource. They might eventually get to the point where they do stuff out of the kindness of their hearts, but it really does need to be that the analyst unit has a dedicated person, maybe not full time, but at least part of the time that they are going to work on the needs of the analyst unit.
Yes, I agree. And like I said, we've really lucked out with having, his name is Bart at Naperville, is because he had that time. So he was assigned to both the police department and the fire department. And he, if I remember correctly, he wasn't a part of like the general like IT request. Like if like my computer stopped working, he wouldn't get those. Like he was separate. Like he focused on those other projects with the databases, as well as some of the dashboards. Like I think he did a lot of dashboards for the fire department as well, which is like really nice for us because he was a huge resource for me, especially if I received a request from the chief or the PIO looking for very specific data that was not easily exportable from like the interface of RMS that I had access to. I could just go to him. I'm like, hey, I need this very unique crime type. How do I get it? And he was like, oh, I can do this and I can do that. And I was like, great. Okay. So like he would just give me an export from SQL, and then I would just manipulate that into a report and be able to provide that to whomever requested it. So like we had a really good thing, and like we were really lucky. Like you said, I don't think a lot of agencies have that. And we were really lucky to have him.
All right, good. And then I want to get your take to finish up this section on call data record analysis software, because you've been blessed in the idea that you've been able to try all these different softwares. So I wanted to get your take on just ones maybe that you like better than the others, maybe rank them in a way, and then maybe if some things that you wish they had that maybe none of them have.
Ooh, that's a good question. I haven't used Trex in a hot minute, but okay. So I started my career with call data records actually using the FBI's CASFIS platform. And so that was going to be like 2018, early 2019. And I'm not sure if they've changed it at all since then, but from what I can remember about it, it was very tricky to use, very challenging. You really had to understand the data and what you're looking at in order to see any sort of output. So if I remember correctly, you were required to drag and drop the column headers of your data set into these different buckets. And I just remember it was a lot of trial and error, where I remember at one point I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. So I just kept moving my column headers to different buckets until something worked. And I found I think it was on the NDCAC website or platform, they had documentation on how to use CASFIS. And so I read that and it was very easy to understand. So that became better. And that also helped me understand what I was looking for. So I started researching the different column headers that this platform was requesting. So like azimuth and beamwidth and radius were all things associated with the call data records that were provided from the cell phone carriers. But at the time I was like, yeah, do I really need to know those column headers? But once I started to understand what exactly those meant in relation to the data, it became easier to use the tools. And so because of that, it made it way easier to use the ArcGIS Pro tool set, because I knew exactly what I needed in order to visualize the data on a map, as well as like generate those phone links to see how often two numbers are communicating with each other in the days. So those two platforms required more work on the user side. So it was just like, okay, what do I need to see, and how do I do that? Whereas Trax, formerly known as ZX, kind of takes all that work out for you, and which is really nice because they make it very easy to use. You just dump your data and it will tell you what it needs or doesn't need. So often when you receive your zip file of your cell phone records from a provider, they'll give you some cell site information, they'll give you the the call data records. They might give you some of that like online data. So like anytime they're using their cellular and they'll provide you with a bunch of documentation. So instead of like figuring out, okay, like which like Excel file CSVs do I need, you could just drag and drop them all. And Zex will be like, okay, this is accepted. This is accepted. We don't need that. And from there, you can kind of just like dig into the data using their already like pre-made tools. So what was nice about that is like it made it simple for anybody to use, an analyst and a detective and an officer, and it's very quick. So that was kind of nice because you were able to find out your relevant information pretty quickly using these tools. I really like the work, so I would always export. So like they would then kind of organize the data into like tables so I could export that back to a CSV and do my own analysis within Excel, or then import that to i2 and I could visualize the network of communications that way. And that was something that like a lot of detectives requested because they wanted to see how often like co-offenders were communicating with each other. And it was very much easier to like visualize that in i2 compared to the platform like Zedix had for that. I guess like I've attended a few trainings of GeoTime, and then there's one more, Hawk Analytics, I think is the other one that has a call data records analysis platform. So I'm not like really familiar with those. And I know a lot of people that use GeoTime and they really like it. I guess like if I had to rank them all, I'd probably put ArcGIS Pro at the top for me, and then the Trax, and then FBI CastViz. The thing with like ArcGIS Pro, I'm more familiar with it. When I would do my call data records analysis for detectives, I always verified that what I was seeing in ZX on the KMZ matched that of ArcGIS Pro. Like you hear it throughout this profession, peer review, peer review, peer review. And so I would peer review myself by using a different platform. And it's like, okay, all of this is good. Let's send it on to the detective. So that's what I really liked about it. But what I really liked with the ZX Tax tool is it was very easy to understand. And the platform itself being web-based, if a detective wanted to go in there after I had already provided analysis for them, they could also check themselves. They could log in and then see that and also run these same tools to find out like peak times or the most frequent number of communication, some outliers. So it's very easy to use for them and very easy to explain. And that's something you don't have with these other tools. Like you kind of become the gatekeeper of that information then, but like with this, it was shared department wide.
All right. Good deal. And then where did you put GeoTime?
Oh, actually, I just don't use it. I don't know. Yeah. I don't want, like, I know a lot of people really like it and probably rank it number one. And the one thing I did really like about it in the trainings I attended of it was that everything is kind of in that platform. With like ZX, you have to use like Google Earth to map out your records. But with GeoTime, the map is like built in. So that was really nice. And yeah, so that's probably, I don't know. I would put it on its own. It's not on the same level since I don't have as much experience with it.
I gotcha. All right. So you hate GeoTime. I got it.
I'm kidding. Onyx, I have GeoTime. I'm not sure what tool they have. So give me a call in 2 months and I'll let you know.
No worries. All right, let's finish up with personal interests. And you're a reader. So what are you reading these days?
So I read a lot, actually. So I really like thrillers, mysteries. I just recently started getting into fantasy, but it's different. But which is funny because like I love like a psychological thriller. And it's like, okay, this is like my job. Why do I want to continue to read about this? But most of the time it's so far-fetched, it's funny. But I really enjoy reading those.
Nice. And you're expecting. So yes, congratulations.
I am. Thank you so much.
All right. So your first child and due in September. And so get your reading in now.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's going to be much reading come September, or sleeping for that matter.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not a very good reader to begin with, but trying to care for a crying baby and reading at the same time is something that I definitely cannot do.
Yeah. No, not. That's going to be quite interesting. Like I always try to like surpass my reading goal from like years prior. And I really set that goal low for 2024. Because I think leading up to September, I'll do well. But after that, it just might take a nosedive.
Yeah, that's different priorities, right? So,
absolutely.
So excited for you and your husband. So fantastic. Congratulations again.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. So the last segment of the show is Words to the World. And this is where I give the guest the last word. Liz, you can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
So my words of the world are going to be to leave your work at work and don't take it home.
Very good. I leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Liz. Thank you so much. And you be safe.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for making it to the end of another episode of Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. You can show your support by sharing this and other episodes found on our website at www.leapodcasts.com. If you have a topic you would like us to cover or have a suggestion for our next guest, please send us an email at leapodcasts@gmail.com. Till next time, analysts, keep talking.